On the Murder Squad, we discuss details of crimes that are often violent in nature. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm Billy Jensen.
I'm Paul Holes.
This is the Murder Squad. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Jensen and Holes' Winter Distraction. Last week, we began our conversation with Hallie Rubenhold, author of The Five. Her book focuses on the untold stories of Jack the Ripper's victims.
Last week, we discussed the first three potential victims of Jack the Ripper and began to talk about the fourth, Catherine Eddowes. Not only will we be finishing our discussion about Jack the Ripper and if there are even more victims, but Hallie will also tell us about her latest project.
And we're also talking about, you know, there were sightings that she might have been seen, you know, we're talking about Elizabeth now, might have been seen around 12:45. Her body was discovered at 1 a.m., still warm. Catherine Kate Eddowes' body was discovered 1:44 a.m. So we're looking at maybe an hour in between. How far is the were the two crime scenes?
I mean, they're not that far apart. I mean, probably about a 10-minute walk.
Mm-hmm.
Depends what route you're going. Yes, it'd be easy enough to get from one place to the other, but presumably, you know, he didn't go there directly.
Right. If his major motivation, Paul, you could talk to, it was the disemboweling, was that, if this was what he was doing it for, he didn't get it because he got interrupted with the first one, then he's going around. He's got to find somebody first. It is, it's 1 a.m., you know, he's looking around. What's it going to find? It's going to have to look around a while.
But there's also a misperception that these types of homicides take a long time. And, you know, the homicide itself, the cutting of a throat is a mere second. Right. It's very, very fast. The victim loses consciousness very fast. And, you know, cutting into the body doesn't take much time at all. So it is possible for somebody within a 15-minute time frame to do some of these mutilations that we're seeing with these victims. Now, one of the things, you know, when we start talking about the motivation of the offender, if we go, he's got Elizabeth Stride. If it's the same offender, and let's say he cuts her throat and for whatever reason doesn't accomplish what he wants to do to that victim, he doesn't get that release, that psychological release that he's looking for. Now he's across the region and finds Kate. And now he can do what he wants to do. And he gets that release. Now he has that psychological release because now he's doing the dissection, the mutilation. This is what he wants. There's an anger aspect. And, you know, he's going after the sexual aspects of these victims, you know, the vaginal areas, the breasts, the uterus. You know, this is a defeminization. That obviously there's a deep psychological issue with this offender. And I know you question whether these are sexually motivated crimes. I will say they're sexually motivated crimes. The dissection is what he is getting, where he is getting his sexual satisfaction. He is not doing the penetration through, you know, traditional sex or sex acts, but he is psychologically getting sexually excited, if you will, during these acts. But he's also expressing some sort of psychological anger towards women for whatever's going on in his past.
One of the other things I was going to suggest about Elizabeth Stride and about this evening, which is referred to as the double event, is that I think there's a chance that Elizabeth Stride's killer was actually her partner. Because Elizabeth Stride was in a very abusive relationship with him. And he used to beat her and she would walk out and then she would go back. And she had recently walked out on him.
Yeah.
And we know what happens in these relationships with a lot of femicide. Mm-hmm. When a woman walks out and a man takes the opportunity to murder the woman.
And I think that, you know, this is actually a very important point, because even to this day, you know, you don't have a lot of gun violence over there in England. I imagine back in 1888, you know, that the primary weapon of choice was either a knife or strangulation.
Yeah.
So homicides are occurring like this and trying to sort out back in the 1880s, you know, which homicides are related becomes much more difficult. We can't just make the assumption because we have a series of women whose throats were slashed. You know, you have one woman whose throat was slashed, but she isn't being mutilated. You know, is it automatically the same guy?
And it happened on the same night. Yeah. At a time of very high alert when people were looking for a killer.
And I personally have experienced that where I've had a woman mutilated and then I had another woman whose head was almost cut off inside a house and her husband's truck basically crashed a few miles away for the first victim. Turns out two completely unrelated incidents, but it happened within an hour of each other. Mm-hmm. You know, back then they don't have DNA and these types of cases aren't amenable to the fingerprint technology that was just starting to come on board. So now, you know, I don't know where I stand in terms of Elizabeth Stride, whether she's related or not, in terms of is she a Ripper victim, but it is something to consider. And that's where victimology is huge. And you brought up she was in an abusive relationship. That has to be taken into consideration.
Yeah. Definitely.
So we get to Mary Kelly, the last, you know, talking about the canonical, this is the canonical five. The double event was September 30th. You have all of October where do we see anything else in October at all?
No, I mean, it's known as the lull, and the press are hanging around in Whitechapel waiting for something to kick off, and nothing kicks off, and, you know, waiting and waiting. And then on November 9th, the most vicious murder of the Whitechapel murders occurs, and that's the murder of Mary Jane Kelly.
Right. So Mary Jane Kelly, she was living in a place called Miller's Court in the months before her murder, and she was living with a guy named Joseph Barnett. She was a sex worker. And now she wasn't just a local woman. She had actually traveled, correct?
Well, it seems that is the case. Now, I mean, I think one of the most fascinating things about Mary Jane Kelly is that she's so enigmatic. We really don't know anything about her to the point that I think we can pretty much say that her name almost certainly wasn't Mary Jane Kelly, because when she was murdered, this was a story that was covered all over the world. She said she was from Wales. She said she was from Ireland. We know that she worked in the West End for a while. And when this name Mary Jane Kelly was out there in the press, and when the police were doing their investigations, not one single person, not a family member, not a friend, no one came forward and recognized who was being described or responded to her name at all. And all of the research that's been done, nobody has ever found in the censuses and the birth records any reference to somebody called Mary Jane Kelly that matches up with what we know about her.
I think, yeah, fundamentally, I'm looking at this going, okay, this is such a huge case. This is basically a Jane Doe who we're calling Mary Kelly.
Yeah.
And we know the location of her body. Today,
yeah,
we might be able to identify her using genealogy.
No, there's no way we can. And that's been raised before. I mean, Patricia Cornwell raised this. She was put in a communal cemetery, in a communal grave. And all of those bodies have now...
They're commingled.
Yes, exactly.
Commingled.
There's no way of finding her.
I see. Yeah, that's rough. Yeah.
Well, how many bodies are we talking about?
Lots. And it raises a lot of ethical issues.
Sure.
Because you'll have to disinter other people.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't it also true that Kate Eddowes, she had been arrested for public drunkenness, I guess, passing out in the street the night before her murder? When she was released, did she give the name Mary Ann Kelly? Is that true?
Yeah, she did. But you have to actually think that Mary Ann and Mary Jane, I mean, poor women often had a kind of combination of five mm-hmm. different names in the Victorian era. It was a Mary, an Anne, a Jane, an Elizabeth, yeah. and a Catherine, and any kind of combination of that.
I was just wondering if it was sort of like that was a name that women would give Mary Kelly, like they would just give that name as a thing, you know?
It could be. I think what's quite interesting about Mary Jane Kelly is that the name Kelly is like one of the most common Irish surnames. She said her name was Kelly. She said she was from Ireland. She also said she was from Wales. But no one who knew her, who described her, ever mentioned an accent of any sort whatsoever. Not only that, but like what completely, you know, contradicts everything she was saying about herself is the descriptions that people gave of her was somebody with a kind of fairly middle-class background, somebody with an education. You know, this picture she presented of herself, of being a poor miner's daughter, seems rather implausible for a number of reasons, because what we know about 19th century sex work and the type of sex work that she worked in the upper echelons of sex work in the West End. And she was almost certainly trafficked to Paris. And she, the way she describes where she was, and she told her boyfriend that she was in Paris, and she didn't like the part, as she said, and then she came back. But she didn't go back to the West End. And what we know about sex work at the time is, like, you just don't slide down the ladder. You don't go from the West End to the bottom in the East End, unless you're hiding from somebody. Mm. And she was hiding from someone. There was a man who came round at some point looking for her after she'd gone back to the West End with her current madam, trying to get her very fancy dresses back. And shortly after that, a man comes round looking for her, saying he's her father, and she hides from him. And then shortly after that, she moves. So there's a lot to suggest that she was hiding from a past. And the fact that we can't identify her, that nobody could match up the pieces after she'd been killed, I think says quite a lot about the fact that she almost certainly was hiding from someone.
Yeah. So she was living with Joseph Barnett.
Yeah.
She had invited another sex worker to stay with them. Barnett moved out. Around 4 a.m. on the 8th, neighbors apparently heard a cry of, "Oh, murder." And apparently, was this common in domestic violence situations, like people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing is, you have to think about what Whitechapel sounds like at night anyway, on any given night. You know, you have, first of all, you have a very high level of homelessness. You have people on the street. You have you have drunken people out on the street. You have a very high population density. People can hear through the windows. There's all sorts of noise all the time. So I don't know, you know, who knows? Maybe she did cry out, "Oh, murder." Well, the one thing we do know is that she was singing before she died. And that was very late into the night. She was singing a song, a violet plucked from my mother's grave. And then that went silent. We don't actually know who she was with. It suggested that she had returned to soliciting at around the time she was killed again. And that's one of the reasons why Joseph Barnett left her. But, you know, again, we have to be incredibly careful with the witness statements, because there's no way of verifying these witness statements now. You know, it's a lot of hearsay.
Because we know that a guy had come to collect the rent, which was overdue, at 10:45 a.m., whether this is true or not. But he knocks on the door, no one answers. He looks in the window, he sees blood on the wall behind the bed.
Yeah.
And we've seen the images from that, and it's probably one of the most gruesome scenes that you'll ever see in true crime.
Yeah.
The only thing that we've got over here that has been widely published is Black Dahlia, Elizabeth Short, but Elizabeth Short was not mutilated. I mean, she was bisected, her insides were removed, but this was just, it's
a bloodbath.
So horrific. And her face is so, so mutilated. You know, she's on her back. She's nude. It seems like a lot of her skin was removed. Yeah. Her breasts were cut off. Her intestines were all of that. So, you know, because we don't know who she was, because she was seemingly the youngest, and because it was, I think, inside, those are the three reasons why whenever anybody is focusing on one of the victims, they go to Mary Kelly.
Yeah, it's the most shocking. I mean, also, it's quite interesting to point out that there's quite a span of time between the double event and Mary Jane Kelly's murder. And It's suggested that the murderer changed his kind of modus operandi. So, because a lot of people would have been looking for somebody outdoors who was killing. And so he chose to kill indoors. And the interesting thing about 13 Miller's Court, where she was living, was that there was a broken window. And Mary Jane and Joseph had actually lost the key to the door. So what they would do is stick their hand through the broken window and release the latch and let themselves in. And now somebody who was passing on a regular basis would have seen that and would have seen that this was a way in which they could let themselves in to that dwelling.
I mean, Paul, what do you think of that? Just like sort of changing, you know, could this guy potentially have changed his MO like this, because because there's also an escalation, because he wants more time potentially.
Yeah. Well, this is what I would expect. You know, when you have an offender that has, he's not psychotic. You know, there is a level of organization to this offender. He's trying to avoid being caught. And if I imagine this is getting a lot of play in the press, and he's recognizing that this is not unusual for an offender to change, because he wants to continue to commit these crimes. And now he's indoors. He has less risk to himself, so he can spend more time with the body. And he's doing to Mary what he wants to do. This is the mutilation aspect. Now, one of the things, you know, to address, and obviously you're touching upon the horrific nature of this crime. I mean, she is torn up. And, you know, this is where, you know, many people, when they hear about these types of predatory crimes, they don't recognize how horrific these types of crimes can be. What I would want to know when I'm assessing this crime, and I can't tell it from the one photo, is, was she alive and conscious at the time these acts were occurring up to a certain point? Or across this series, is the offender cutting their throats very early on, where now the victims are essentially dead and he is now doing all the mutilation? This has great impact in terms of assessing this offender and his motivations. Is he a sadist, where he gets off on the pain and suffering of the victim? Or now you're dealing with somebody who is more, I don't know if a psychiatrist would characterize it as a necrophilia, but the post-mortem mutilation, the defeminization, the taking out the anger, is a different psychological aspect than the sadist. And so that's one of those things, as I'm assessing this, as horrific as Mary's crime scene looks, if everything except the throat slashing was post-mortem, then it's a different beast than a sexual sadist. And that's part of what I would want to know. And I don't know if there could be any answers. Is there any physical evidence in any of these cases?
I mean, bodies that still exist.
Clothing material, bedding, anything like that with the victim's blood on it.
Nothing.
And wasn't there a scarf at some point? I think, wasn't Patricia Cornwell?
Oh, God. Are we talking about the Edo Shoal? This is, oh, dear.
Yes. All right. Let's talk about that for a second. Because, and listen, whenever somebody comes out, and this is one of the things I hate about media, mainstream media, because we saw this recently with the Zodiac Killer, where somebody comes out and says, we saw the Zodiac Killer, and then everybody runs with it. The same thing, it seems like, with this shawl.
Oh, God.
So what was going on with this shawl?
Oh, the shawl is the biggest red herring ever. I mean, the shawl, it's so wrong in so many ways. I mean, it is a perfect example of bad science and bad history. There was a collector who said he got it from somebody's family, who said it was all, you know, that some relative was a police officer who was there on the scene and took this There's no evidence that, and we have a full inventory of Catherine Eddowes' clothes, and there's no evidence that it was there. And as a former curator, I can tell you that you need to have a provenance for any object. If you don't have a provenance, there's no verification. End of story. It doesn't even go any further. You can't even say it. It doesn't hold any water. But then the DNA aspect of it doesn't hold any water either. And Turi King, Professor Turi King, who at the University of Leicester, who identified the remains of Richard III and is extremely well known in her field, said that just the DNA, that they, the DNA tests that they ran on this were flawed. The paper isn't kosher at all. And not only that, but the shawl itself was handled by so many people, and there's so many people's DNA on it from breathing on it and everything. It's just a non-starter, really.
So this was a, just so everybody knows, you can Google it, you know, just Google Jack Ripper shawl DNA. This had come out in 2000, late 2000s, late 2010s, like 2018, 19.
It just keeps rearing its head, and it's just, it's a complete red herring. There's just, yeah.
Yeah. They were pointing to a guy named Aaron Kosminski, yeah, who was a 23-year-old Polish barber.
Yeah.
And saying that this was the guy that that had did it.
Yeah.
And he had actually been on the list. He was apparently a suspect.
Yeah. Well, there, you know, I mean, a lot of people have been on the list. Yeah. And I think, you know, you've got to take it with a pinch of salt. I mean, and this is one of the things that people find so frustrating about this case, is that we're just not going to be able to pin it on anybody in particular, simply because what remains from this case just isn't strong enough.
Yeah.
You know, to stand up anything, really.
No, you know, yeah. And I've got personal experience with this, whether it be, you know, from Zodiac or Golden State Killer, is absent any physical evidence that could identify the offender, you could build a circumstantial case against so many people, especially when you're speculating over what now, almost 130 years ago,
yeah,
is that I would not put any weight on any name anybody says is Jack the Ripper unless they can say we got his DNA from an article of evidence that was collected from a crime scene. That's where I stand, or some just almost fantastical type of set of circumstances that allows physical evidence to objectively identify somebody. So I think I agree with what you said very early on, is that this is not going to be a solved case. I would be very interested to dig in this case if there is physical evidence, you know, but now I would just be doing the same thing everybody else is doing and speculating.
I mean, this is going to sound really gruesome, but when I did the DB Cooper thing, the FBI was so sick of dealing with it. They said, we're closing this case. We're putting all of the evidence into DC. The only time we will take a phone call is if you have the money or you have the parachute. And it's sort of like that. So this is going to sound really gruesome. If there's no evidence on the other side, on the police side of stuff from the crime scene, if they open up a secret chamber in somebody's house, and they happen to find human remains, and then they test those human remains, that's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. So, you know, so that's where, you know, now we get back to who these women were, you know, and no matter, you know, what these women's life circumstances were, you know, their lives were stolen. And, you know, that's what you're doing is important.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I would love to see a book like this about the Bundy victim. Really, every, you know, just one of the things that I've noticed in true crime is that the more victims a serial killer has, the less you know about those victims, you know, because they just become a number then, and they just get all sort of, you know, unfortunately merged together, as opposed to if somebody, you know, four or five people, then you're going to know more about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is something that happened. So, well, I think the last thing is, and we want to talk about your current project too, that you're working on. What is, you know, so that was this really the last murder in November of this type? Did anything happen within the next 5 years, say?
Well, you see, there's, I mean, I, I chose to look at these five women simply because I think my whole remit for the project was not necessarily to look at the crimes of Jack the Ripper, but to look at the state of marginalized Victorian womanhood. And so I took five women, they were a cross section of that particular data set. Mm-hmm. But people argue, the Whitechapel murders, there could be 11, there could be 12, there could be, and people argue ad infinitum, mm-hmm. there could be, many more than that he killed. So, there were women who were killed afterwards. It's questionable. There's the Thames torso murder, a torso of a woman was found in the Thames. There are lots of other similar crimes that were committed, but whether they can actually be pinned on Jack the Ripper is again, I said, questionable.
Gotcha. So as far as you've got this, you also have a podcast.
Yeah.
How can people find that podcast too, before we get into the next thing that you're working on?
So I've just done a podcast. It's 15 episodes. It's called Bad Women, The Ripper Retold, and it's with Pushkin. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. And we basically explode all of the myths of Jack the Ripper. And we look at all of the women's lives in much more detail. And we also look at the legends surrounding it. And we get experts in, everyone from sex workers to judges to criminologists to historians, to just unpick the mythology. And I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm. I just want to revisit one thing, because I'm kind of like going nuts here. This commingled grave that Mary Kelly was put in, is that a commingled grave with other Jane and John Does, essentially, or indigent people?
Well, it was a pauper's grave.
Yeah.
So I think the circumstances of people's lives would be quite similar to Mary Jane Kelly's.
Because I'm just kind of wondering, to me, it almost sounds like a mass grave in which everybody in there is probably, you don't know who they are. And I would say now authorities have an obligation to identify everybody in that grave and repatriate those remains.
Except we do know who they are. We do know who they are.
You're sure?
Yeah.
Oh, we do know who they are. Okay.
They're not anonymous. They're just poor.
They're just poor with identified family.
Yeah, they will have identified families. I mean, again, this is something that Turi King was involved with. Yeah. She was hired by Patricia Cornwell to actually look into the viability of disinterring the body. And they came back with a report that said absolutely, categorically, they couldn't do this for a number of reasons. I mean, one of which was, the ethics of it were just, they just couldn't go forward with it.
So if you go to, it's the St. Patrick's Roman Catholic Cemetery in London, if you go there, there is actually a headstone for her. And it says, in loving memory of Mary Jeanette Kelly. And the quote is, none but the lonely hearts can know my sadness. Love lives forever. But it's not as if, she's there somewhere, but it's not as if she's right below the headstone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. We don't know where she is.
So what are you working on now? I know you're working on a book about the murder of Belle Elmore. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is what I'm really excited about. And I have to say, after spending basically 3 years talking about this book, I'm really, really keen to move on to something else. So I'm
all ears that.
Yeah. So I'm writing a book about somebody who is very well known in the UK and not so well known in the US. And that's Dr. H.H. Crippen, who murdered his wife, Belle Elmore, in 1910 in London. But the Crippens were both Americans. And so the story takes place half in the United States and half in the UK. It's a completely transatlantic cast. But Crippen is a really fascinating character, mainly because there's been a lot of energy poured into who, what he was and what he did to his wife and the story about how he ran off with his mistress and then he was caught by Marconi Wireless and on the ship and brought back and put on trial and his mistress was acquitted and then he was executed. But there are a lot of questions still hanging around this. And well, one of the questions, one of the things I've looked at, is whether he killed his first wife in Salt Lake City. Mm. And I went to Salt Lake City this summer and did some investigating. I think it's quite hard to tell. I'm not going to reveal anything yet because I that's going to come out in the book. But the interesting thing is, what I'm doing that's different about this is that, you know, if you look at the Crippen story through the eyes of all of the women he was involved with, and it's a story that is populated by women. I mean, women, music hall performers and female doctors and all of these incredibly strong women all around him. And if you look at the story, if you tell the story through the eyes of the first wife, who he may or may not have killed, the second wife who he did kill, and the mistress who he ran off with, and the other women in his life, you get a much clearer picture of this man and what he was, and that he was a misogynist, and you could see it very early on. And there was a lot of doubt whether Crippen, who was supposed to be this very kind of mild-mannered little tiny man, was capable of basically carving up his wife and hiding her in the cellar. And if you look at his behavior from very early on, it's very, very easy to see what was coming.
Yeah, believe it or not, I actually know of this case.
Yes.
It was very early on in my career. I worked for a crime lab that had this amazing library of historic texts. And one of the texts, which I talk about, I've actually got a book coming out too, but one of the texts was related to the Ruxton case over there in Britain. And it may have been in that text, or it may have been a separate text, but the Crippen case was talked about and talked about the anthropological work that was done, you know, and eventually I think what they hung him like, what, a month after he was sentenced to death or something like that.
So in November. Yeah.
Fascinating case from early on in my career. You know, it was just so I'm looking forward to seeing what you have found out.
Great. I mean, it's an incredibly colorful story as well. And. You know, I'm telling the story as a kind of lens, a view into the time period as well and what it can tell us. I think one of the reasons why I'm so interested in true crime is a snapshot of a time and a place. And it tells us about people and the mores and society and the problems with society. And it's a really good measure for understanding what was going on in any given place at a particular time.
Absolutely.
And that's kind of my approach. And that's why I'm really interested in what true crime can tell us about, you know, ourselves and our past.
We want to thank Hallie again for joining us. You can follow her on Instagram and Twitter at Hallie Rubenhold and on Facebook at Hallie Rubenhold Books.
Thank you very much for joining us. Please rate, review, subscribe, which would be wonderful. Go buy some merch. Follow us on social. Until then, keep digging.
And don't be an irony. Jensen and Holes, The Murder Squad, is produced by Exactly Right Media and Bench Clearing Productions. Senior producer, Pauly Katowski. Associate producer, Haley Gray. Engineer, Stephen Ray Morris. Music, Tom Breifogel. Executive producers, Karen Kilgara, Georgia Hardstark, Danielle Kramer.